I'm James Watt, and this is Neuropod Podcast. We have an exciting lineup of guests for you in the upcoming months as we continue our long-format interviews with some extremely interesting personalities in the field of neurodiagnostics. Welcome to Episode 2, and I hope you enjoy the show. In Episode 2, our guest is Michelle Mora, a triple-boarded neurologist with interests in EEG and intraoperative neuromonitoring. In this episode, we hear about Michelle's days as a wildland firefighter, her interest in geology, and the impact her family and mentors had on her life and career. She discusses the DNA of a quality reading physician and what makes an excellent technologist. She talks about her volunteer work with TeleEEG and venturing out on her own. As the ASNM president-elect, she discusses her aspirations for the organization and her concerns about the field of intraoperative neuromonitoring. She talks about taking control of our own destiny and what that means for the field. We hope you enjoy this conversation and come back next week for Episode 3 of Neuropod Podcast. If you like what you hear, please consider subscribing on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you access your podcast content. Well, Dr. Mora, welcome to Neuropod Podcast. It's great to have you on the show today. But before we get started, Dr. Mora or Michelle?
Michelle would be terrific.
Okay. All right. I'll call you Michelle then.
So.
Well, thank you for joining us after a long day of monitoring cases.
So, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, okay, so tell the Neuropod community about yourself. Let us know, you know, who you are, what you do, and you know, some interesting things about yourself.
Interesting things. So my name's Dr. Michelle Mora. I'm a remote oversight physician for intraoperative monitoring, and I also read EEGs remotely. I'm triple boarded in neurology, clinical neurophysiology, and IONM. And I tend to like to do some of the lesser done stuff. So if there's anything rare or complex, that's kind of what I like to specialize in. I also did one of my fellowships was in epilepsy, so I specialize in intraoperative EEG as well.
Okay, and where did you do your fellowships?
Yeah, so I actually did all of my postgraduate training in Michigan.
Okay,
my all residency right. was through the Ascension Health System, based out of Detroit. That was adult neurology. And then I did my fellowships in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan.
Okay, nice. And what led you to the field of neurology?
Gosh, probably just a bunch of happy accidents along the way. I was one of those people in training that I didn't necessarily have a plan. My husband, for example, he knew what kind of doctor he wanted to be probably since he was old enough to walk.
Gotcha.
He wanted to be like his dad. I didn't. I tried a little bit of everything, as you kind of have to do as a medical student, and I liked everything. The only thing, shockingly, that I didn't like was actually psychiatry, which is odd considering if neurology is the hardware, then psychiatry is the software. You would think that would be enjoyable. That was the only thing I was like, no, not cut out to do this.
Gotcha.
But I liked everything. And when I got to neurology, I just happened to have a bunch of really good preceptors. The one who got me into it was Dr. Matthew Hoffman over at Maine in Detroit. And he was just, he had the personality and the brain that just really drew you in. So
gotcha.
Having liked everything, he made me like that just a little bit more.
Nice. Okay. And in neurology, you have a pretty varied background then, it sounds like. You've done epilepsy, you've done IONM, and what was your third?
Clinical neurophysiology.
Okay, clinical neurophysiology. So how did you end up doing three different specializations?
Gosh.
You just like school?
cheating a little bit, because some of them, there's a lot of overlap actually between the three of them. People might argue that, but I think the physiologic basis of all three is very similar. And they were kind of uniquely connected in Ann Arbor. There was just an ease of being able to do those three. I don't know that I would have been as fortunate had I gone other places, not knowing how they worked. Gotcha. So I think it was kind of yet another happy accident of just landing in the right place at the right time.
Nice. And of the three, what is your favorite? Epilepsy or ILM, or is it hard to pin down one?
I guess at this point, it's probably ILM. I will say that epilepsy is what got me started in ILM.
Okay.
So that's kind of like a first love kind of thing. But if you ask me right now what my favorite is, it's probably ILM, just because it's a bit more varied. I'm doing it more every day. The volume of IONM studies that I read is higher than the volume of EEG studies that I read.
Gotcha.
So I think
okay.
just by volume, it's probably IONM is the winner.
Okay. And are you, when you do EEG, excuse me, when you do EEG, are you reading mostly your routine studies, or are you doing some epilepsy, long-term reads
as
well?
I would love to get back into the long-term, like the EMU. Right now, it's mostly critical care.
Okay.
It's not even mostly critical care. It's mostly routines with some critical care.
Okay.
So a lot of the work comes actually from a volunteer organization based out of Wales called TeleEEG. Dr. Stephen Coates, I think, is the one who set that up, and he provides training, equipment, and oversight reading to countries that otherwise wouldn't have it. So I've been able to read in a bunch of countries in Africa, Guyana, Nepal, Pakistan, Ukraine.
Nice.
And if there's ever anything that's humbling, it's reading EEGs from those countries. We have no idea how spoiled we are here in America, how good we have it, the access to healthcare. Even if it's not the greatest, not the top of the line healthcare, we are very, very fortunate.
Fortunate, yeah. Yeah, I imagine if you're reading for some of those countries, you're seeing brain death for, the disease just left me. Mosquito, you get bit by a mosquito.
Malaria?
Malaria, yes. I imagine you're seeing cases of malaria where you're having to read electrocerebral silence studies and things like
yes.
that.
Yes. Well, and some of it, it's not even to that point. It's just before then, and it's some epileptiform patterns that you know that's the unfortunate
progression
stage. Mm-hmm, exactly.
Right.
And to see like some of these patterns go without the treatment available is just shocking. Absolutely.
Yeah, it is crazy. I mean, yeah, especially some of the things that we would be able to treat here and patients would do just fine. I remember years ago I was monitoring, I was teaching a couple of nurses to do evoked potentials in Malawi. And while I was there, we had a patient come in with tetanus and, you know, they didn't have the respirator to put the patient on. And so, you know, it was sad, to see what was, you know, going to happen there. But, how long have you been reading for, this organization?
For this one, gosh, I think since 2001. So not too long, 3 years.
Okay. 2001.
Sorry. 2021.
Oh, 21. Okay. All right. I was going to say, you've been reading a very long time for
it. It's been a long day. 2001, gosh, I'm going to date myself here, but that's when I graduated high school. If I'm reading EEGs at that age, then oh my.
Awesome. Okay. Now you're making me feel old because I graduated I graduated high school in 92. So
did you really?
Yes, I did. So
I would never guess that. You have such a young looking face.
Well,
oh,
thanks. Oh, that's funny. So how did, or why, medicine?
My mom.
Okay.
My mom.
She in medicine or?
She was. She was a physician's assistant. I mean, she's actually been in healthcare. She was in healthcare over four decades in various roles. She was a nurse. She was what's called a diabetes educator. I don't know if that role still exists, but it's exclusively taking care of patients with diabetes. She was a physician's assistant. As a physician's assistant, she held numerous roles. Her love was surgery. So she was first assist and the surgical PA for a group in Colorado for a long time. But to ease into retirement, she did things like occupational medicine and urgent care and other things like that. Going back to not, some people have a plan from the very beginning. They know what they're going to do. I was not that person. I had kind of a vision, but not a clear cut plan. And the vision was always higher education of some kind. Mm-hmm. I did like to learn. And I remember calling my mom, end of my freshman year at Colorado State University, because they were on me to declare a major. You had to declare a major before you entered your sophomore year. I said, I have no idea what to do. And she said, well, you like helping people. Why don't you be a doctor? And I was just like, sold. I'll do
it. That's it.
That was it. So nice. I got to do some cool things with her. For some of my externships, I got to rotate with her. And that was awesome. Absolutely awesome.
Nice. So what was the one thing that stands out that you learned from your mom while you were rotating with her?
Bedside manner.
Gotcha.
She was just the kindest, sweetest, most patient. She could take the most gruff, most angry, most surly patient or family member. And when we're walking into the room, and by the time we're walking out of the room, I mean that she has their phone number, she knows their kids' names, they're calmed down, just how to really deal with people in a way that I've never seen. I've tried very hard to model my bedside manner after hers. I don't come close.
Gotcha. Well, and now you don't have to have a whole lot of bedside manner because you're doing everything remotely, right?
That's kind of a running joke, or it was when I first started. I think that In medicine, when you have that kind of patient interaction, you're bound to get burnt out. It happens to every single physician. And I was definitely feeling that. And so when I first started monitoring, she's like, how's it going? And I said, I didn't have to talk to anyone today. It was the best day ever. And she just laughed at me. It was a running joke for a long time. So
that's funny.
Yeah. How funny is that? That's the one thing I learned from her. And yet I don't get to use it quite as much. So.
Well, but you actually use it more than I think you realize, because of all the reading neurologists that, I've had the opportunity to work with. And I think of talking to a lot of individuals, you're kind of at the top of the list of individuals that people like to have on their cases, because of your not your bedside manner, but your interaction, with the individuals on the other side of the computer. So
I can see that it definitely shifted. So instead of taking that energy to patients, taking that energy to the technologists, for sure.
So, do you get into the OR at all, or is everything that you do remote?
Everything is remote. I would gladly go to the OR if the opportunity arises. I do miss it. There's actually a bunch of things I miss about not being on site. So being able to go to the OR at a moment's notice is one of them. And then pre-op and post-op follow-up, especially on cases like really high risk. So like neuro-oncology cases, whether it's brain or spine, where there's a very real risk of potential deficits or potential damage. That is one thing I miss a lot, is knowing that I did the exam on that patient. Yeah, they do have 4+ out of 5 strength in their right upper extremity. Everything else is okay. It's not just, they move their arms kind of thing.
Right.
They do have a Hoffman's, positive on that side. Like these little things that kind of tell me, okay, I think that patient's going to do okay as long as we stay within the boundaries. And then this patient, I don't know how they're going to do. I bet our signals aren't going to be good.
Right.
That
right.
I really miss. And then following up too, anytime I get any follow-up from anyone, it's whether it's good or bad, it's the best day ever, just because there are some cases and it's like, I will be losing sleep about this case tonight, about
right,
this
right.
I'll be thinking about them. So I do miss that. But if there were an opportunity, I would love to get back into the OR kind of on a per diem basis.
Gotcha. Okay. And you're located in California now, right?
Yeah. For the time being, California, hopefully not indefinitely. It feels like a long time already.
How long have you been in California?
Let's see. We moved back at the end of training, which was middle of 2016. So we're going on 8 years.
Okay. All right. And Colorado is ultimately where you're hoping to end up?
It was. I think just based on where family is now, we're looking still in the mountain and central time zones, but anywhere. We have family in Montana, Utah, Texas, so probably somewhere like that.
Okay. All right. Gotcha.
Colorado would be nice. I would not object. I don't know that I'll get the rest of my family on board with that. We'll have to see how it goes.
Gotcha. We enjoyed Colorado while we were out there. There's so much to see and so much to do. You can take a different drive or a different hike every weekend, and you know, never see the same thing twice.
Were you were in Lakewood? No, where were you?
We were in Littleton.
Littleton. Okay.
Yep. We still have a house out there, actually.
Nice. Do you get to go back at all, or you've probably been too busy?
I have not been back yet. I've flown through the airport there a couple of times, but this summer we're probably going to go back just to check on things and make sure, you know, everything's good. So
yeah, but hopefully there's not that situation where like the squatters move in and take over the house.
Well, it's rented right now, and they're paying the rent, so that's a good thing. So
excellent, good, best case scenario.
Exactly. So, during your career, your life, so far, what, one accomplishment would you say you are the most proud of?
That is a really interesting question. I've been asked this before and I am not able to give a great answer. I've had some definite big moments, for sure. Graduating really at any level, particularly med school, getting through residency, all of that. There's not one that I can think of that just meant like the world to me. The ones that I remember actually don't even concern me. They concern family and friends that I'm just so impressed with and so proud of. My older brother, for example, so he moved out to Japan. He's fluent in Japanese, English. He speaks some Spanish. And like just seeing the life that he made out there, that just warms my heart.
Nice.
My brother, my other younger brother in Southern California, completing his master's degree, I just thought was so cool. My mom herself has 3 degrees. She is just super impressive.
Nice.
My good friend Kiara Ebinger actually just won the ASNM, one of the winners of the ASNM Service Award.
She definitely deserved that.
I know that sounds cheesy. That other people's accomplishments actually probably mean more to me than anything I've done, but they're just seeing the people you really care about be honored and accomplish these things. That I don't know that I have that same feeling for myself for any one accomplishment.
So what you're saying is we're going to have to ask someone else of which accomplishment you should be the most proud.
If you were to ask my husband, if you were to ask my husband, I think one of the things, you'd never know it looking at me now, but one of the things that I think drew him to me is in med school, we had to get up and introduce ourselves in front of the class. It was ridiculous. But we had to say something unique about ourselves. And the only thing I could come up with was what my work was for the past 3 summers. I was a wildland firefighter
for 3 seasons
with Larimer County Sheriff's Department. And so I didn't think much of it because it was a part of my life, but I got up there and said that. And I think he found that super impressive. I thought it was a ton of fun, but it's not anything that I'm like, oh, I'm super proud of myself. But that's probably what he would say.
Gotcha. Nice. Okay. Well, interesting. I did not know you were a firefighter before.
No, I was much younger and much thinner when that happened. I remember going to one of my med school interviews and the guy looked at me kind of funny. And he's like, it says on here, you're a firefighter. I was expecting this like 5'10", you know, really big lady. And here I am at like 5'3". I think I was like 140 pounds at the time. So I was like, yeah, they'll let just anybody in.
As long as you can sling a hose and carry it, right?
That's right. That's right. Aim the hose, swing the axe. Life is good.
That's funny. All right. Well, so how did you find your way to where you are now? You know, doing intraoperative monitoring as a remote reading neurologist. How did the path lead to that?
That's just like an extension of the little happy accidents, I think. I actually got into my residency and thought, oh gosh, I've made a huge mistake. Like I didn't feel like I was a good doctor. I think probably everybody feels that when you're in your internship and first real year of residency. And I was having those feelings big time. Gotcha. I was already into neurology at that point, but I had, in addition to Dr. Hoffman, I had some really great preceptors that really kind of inspired me and kept me going and showed me some different ways to do things, how to take care of patients. One of them is the medical system on the western side of Michigan. Is that Spectrum?
It was Spectrum. I think they may have changed their name now, but yeah, Spectrum.
Oh, really? I'll have to look. So at Spectrum, before he was there, I had a preceptor, Dr. David Burdett. I had him a couple of times. I had him for my EEG rotations as a resident, and then I made sure to get extra rotations with him because he's just so good. He's an epileptologist. But the more I worked with him, the more just cool things that I unlocked. I really was thinking, gosh, I need to like go and see some live brain somewhere, somehow. And he's like, well, let's go do some stage one in the EM, you know, stage one and two in the EMU, and we'll do some extra operative mapping. And that just was amazing. Nice. That for me sealed it, that I have to do something along these lines. This is what I enjoy. This is what I understand. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a little bit what you're made for in some way.
Interesting. EEG is one of those things that, especially as neuromonitoring trained individuals, sometimes EEG is one of those, I guess, enigmas for people where, you know, they get somatosensory vote potentials, they get transcranial motor vote potentials, they even, you know, get EMG, but then you move into EEG and, you know, all the squiggles kind of are confusing for people sometimes. So that's interesting that was kind of where you found your happy place, I guess.
It was definitely a happy place. I would love to be able to try to demystify EEG for people a bit. In my opinion, I mean, you can break it down into three main things: montage, continuity, symmetry. And so I'm trying to talk about EEG as much as I can, wherever I can, I feel like the more it's around and the more, you know, that you know, hey, I don't have to know every little thing. I don't have to know 3 hertz spike and wave. I don't have to know Panayotopoulos syndrome. I don't have to even know what lateralized periodic discharges are. I just know that something's continuous or not, symmetric or not, and then I'm using the right montage.
Right.
That would be like my one woman crusade.
So the talk that you gave at ASNM, that was an excellent talk. I've never heard anybody break EEG down quite like that before, and I think that talk cleared things up for several people that were in the audience listening to that. So I know that you know, in my organization, a couple of the other individuals were there, and we were discussing, you know, that it made a whole lot more sense to people. So that was awesome. Great.
I'm really glad to hear that. I think it just takes a lot of repetition too. I'm one of those people that I have to hear, see, and do things over and over before I get it. My husband is the exact opposite. He can like read something and he's got it immediately. I wish I had that. I don't. And so I think the more you can just like go over those topics and really lean into the stuff that you're not comfortable with. I'm hoping that if I forcibly make people lean into EEG, that they'll be like, oh, this isn't so bad.
Yeah, it's not as bad as it.
No, yeah, it's not. It's not. So fingers crossed.
Well, good job. We'll definitely have to have you give that talk a few more times. So,
yeah, I would love to. I would love to.
All right. So, intraoperative neuromonitoring. Now, you when you started out with intraoperative neuromonitoring, you worked for one of the larger reading organizations in the U.S. RTNA, but now you're out kind of doing your own thing, aren't you?
I am. So I was with RTNA from 2016 to the end of 2022. It was really tough to leave. They are a wonderful company. I still have a lot of friends there. But I did want to do things, I guess, my way.
Gotcha.
And so that's essentially what it came down to. So it was essentially, it was taking a leap, really, because I was afraid that I'd get out here and find, you know, the grass was greener where I was at kind of thing. But I really have liked being on my own. 2023 was a little bit of a mess for me for personal reasons. I had a close family member diagnosed with terminal cancer.
And
she unfortunately passed. But I was able to set up my own practice. I was able to start monitoring and I've learned so much. It's been terrific.
Nice. I imagine you've learned not only a whole lot about you already knew the intraoperative piece, but I imagine you've learned a whole lot about running a business and everything that goes into the business side of things.
Yeah, that's been nuts. If you would have asked me even 2 years ago when I was still with RTNA, if I'd ever like be on my own or own my own business, I never in a million years thought I would. Mm-hmm. So this has been wild. If you want to talk about leaning into stuff you're not comfortable to, I've been doing that this year. And it's been really great. And what boggles my mind is even with how much I've learned, there's still so much I don't know. And I'm learning a lot of it along the way. But so far, things have been going very well.
So what is the biggest lesson you've learned on the business operations side of things since you've been running your own business?
The government sucks. Specifically, the government of California.
You had to start your own business to learn that.
Well, how about to really drive it home? Now I know just how bad it really is. Just all of the ridiculous kind of red tape. You hear stories about it and people talk about it and they call it just that, right? The bureaucratic red tape. But actually getting out of that web and trying to make sure everything is done properly and appropriately, just those kinds of things, especially in, I think it is easier in other states. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. California doesn't make it clear and doesn't make it easy. That's like typical government, right?
Gotcha.
So it's not clear, not easy. You really have to dig and do some reading, but I am hopeful that all of that paid off. And then just the little ins and outs of things. So RTNA, and I think other groups like it are kind of a one-stop shop if you're a physician, right? They take care of your credentialing, reporting, all sorts of things. And I don't think many people would agree with me, but I actually kind of like doing all of that on my own. I feel like there's a level of understanding and intimacy there. Intimacy and understanding like my clients and the surgeons better and preferences and things like that. That has actually been very interesting. I don't like busy work, but I have no problem doing any of that. That has been very, very interesting.
Interesting. And I imagine you had to learn all about marketing and contract negotiations and all of that stuff too.
Contract negotiations. If there is one thing I do hate, it's that. And anyone who I was talking to knows that I did have some legal help with that. Like I have that all done, but I was letting a legal team do that for me in the beginning. Never again.
Really?
Yeah. So all the bad jokes you hear about lawyers, I'm sure they probably joke about us too, right? About medicine and about doctors and about anyone involved in that. But I'm just like, you guys have lived up to your reputation. Bravo.
So, oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Can't live with them, but you can't live without them.
That's exactly right. And I'm pretty naive to the whole process. I will say that there are things, you know, that I didn't know I had to include in there that you really got to include. But it's kind of amazing to me how cutthroat some of this part of the business is. Mm-hmm. I find it very unfortunate because I'm not wanting to price gouge or do anything like that. I just wanted to work and to have a good relationship with clients. And it's shocking that there's hurdles to that. There can be. I didn't encounter any. All of my clients are wonderful. Thank you, everybody. it's amazing. Like I can tell from talking to them that they've probably been through some stuff, mm-hmm. having to talk to others. And I find that mind blowing in the worst way.
Yeah, it is. It can be crazy out there on the contract side of things. So, so changing gears just a little bit. So what makes a excellent IONM reading physician? What are the qualities and the things that make a good reader?
That is a very good question. I would almost want to ask that of technologists. I really would love to get some feedback. If you're asking me, I think there's three big things. Number one is courtesy. Mm-hmm. I can't believe how much that's lacking. And it takes nothing to say please and thank you and to be, you know, hospitable. Mm-hmm. And that kind of ties in with number two, and that's patience. I feel, this is a personal opinion, I feel that any reading physician worth their weight has been in the OR and hooked patients up. And if you've done that, you know what a hostile environment that is. Mm-hmm. I always felt like places like the ER and the OR, they're kind of their own little microbiome. And we, people who don't work there all the time, we're kind of like the antigens that macrophages are trying to like eat up and spit out. Like you do what you need to do, and we're getting you out of here as quick as you know you can. So I kind of feel like unless you've been there and you've really established some rapport, it's a tough space to be. And to think about what the technologists have to go to, you're stuck between three of the neediest people on the planet: the surgeon, the anesthesiologist, and the neurologist. So have a little bit of patience. And then three is competence. You do have to pay attention. You do have to know what you're doing. There are things that technologists know and are good at that I'll never be good at. But there are also things that I know and am good at that the technologists will never know.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, we're a team. Make sure that you're competent in your part and make sure that you're patient and have some courtesy. And that can go, in my opinion, a very long way.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And, you know, as a technologist, I mean, I think I echo the things that you've said. I mean, you know, one of the biggest frustrations for technologists is, you know, not getting, you know, communication, you know, in a timely manner. You know, you're in there, things are happening quickly. You know, you're not the one doing the interpretation. You're, you know, we're waiting for, you know, the reading neurologist to provide that. And then, you know, sometimes silence, So that is a big issue. You know, I think that frustrates a lot of technologists. I imagine one of the things that I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, because there is, in my time in neuromonitoring, I've had the opportunity to see a lot of different levels of training on the technologist side of things, different ways of doing things, sometimes, really good ways of doing things, and then other times, not providing what I would consider, the best patient care. So how as a neurologist do you kind of deal with that? And, do you have some minimum standards of, technologists that you're willing to work with? Or how do you handle that as a neurologist that works for multiple companies?
That is an excellent question. And it's a tough one to answer, because I think it would vary depending on the neurologist that you ask the question to. So you could argue for the good of the field, we should be demanding minimum requirements of our technologists. For example, the CNIM certification. Mm-hmm. Some of my clients have techs that are not CNIM certified. I try to do the best I can with whatever is given to me. And so if that person is not CNIM certified and it's clear that there is a knowledge gap, that's where courtesy and patience can really come in, and trying to find ways to communicate with them to maybe mm-hmm. alter things or get them to what I want to do. For example, I'll say something like, thanks for trying so far. Do you think a lower rep rate might help the SSEPs? Do you think, 2.17 or 1.4 hertz is worth a try? Mm-hmm. And I find that if you're patient and you're courteous about that, 9 times out of 10, they do what you need to do. And if not, I try to be available by phone or just say, it's okay, you're doing okay. I do think we need to work with different skill levels. And that could be extrapolated, from the text to the reading doctors too. Mm-hmm. I'm for better or worse, I'm probably apt to be more tough on the reading physicians just by nature of our education. Mm-hmm. Like you should be able, if you've gotten this far, you should be able to know the minimum requirements, the ACNS guidelines, the right. minimum standards. But if, I don't think you can extend that directly to a tech. I think you do have to work a little bit with what you have. And some of the best techs that I've worked with are those that maybe don't have the training, maybe don't have that professional finesse, but are sure willing to try and right, to try right. anything. And if you're nice to them, they respond so much better. So should we have a minimum? I think ideally, probably the reality right now is that we don't.
Right.
And so because we don't, I would want to work. If that's the person taking care of that patient, what can I do to make you comfortable, to kind of lift you up? I'm right here with you, even though I'm states away. Let me know what you need. How can I be helpful to you? That right, would be right. most important in my eyes.
So how do you approach, the multiple case issue, as far as how do you determine what is a reasonable number of cases for you to monitor that you can provide, the appropriate attention to, and what's too much, or what are the factors mm-hmm. that go into determining that for you?
That's a really good question. So just through experience and not all of it good over the years, I do think there's a limit. Yeah. I do think there's a threshold. It might be slightly different for some people, but I think especially the farther in my career that I get, the less I actually want to be doing it once.
Gotcha.
Because things are so much different now. Even in my relatively short time in this field, just from a medical legal standpoint, I think that there's that risk is much higher now than it was when I first came into the field.
Gotcha.
I think, so for me, what it boils down to is case type, right? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, if I've got six microdiscectomies going on at once, that's a lot different than like six CEAs at once.
So right,
it depends
right.
on case type. It also depends on, I guess what my system is I like to do something that I kind of think in my head of as like I&M rounds, you know, am I looking at each one at a reasonable time? Do I know what each one is doing? Do I know what has been going on? And if I can't keep up with that, then that's my cue. Like I need to take a step back. And I used to be able to monitor a lot more, in my early days of monitoring, like 10 plus at once. I do not think that's a good idea at all.
Gotcha.
Do not think that's a good idea at all. I know that that there is incentive to do that, whether it's financially or otherwise. I just don't think it's worth the cost of patient care.
Yeah.
At all. So I guess it would be, can I look at these and be able to answer? Like if I can't answer within the minute, if I can't answer within 30 seconds of what I'm doing, then I have too many cases going.
Right, right.
And I do think you should be able to answer that quickly. The only time I don't is if I'm writing like a book to the tech right, or something right. like that. Some of these, like if we have changes on a case, my closing paragraph can be kind of big. And gotcha. Sorry to anyone who's listening to this, who has gotten one of those, or for any other reason, like, mapping cases where we have after discharges. I had one go into a seizure and describing the not just the electrical component, but the clinical component and what we mm-hmm. did, what was recommended. Like that was a book.
Right.
So I think that we really as a field should look at doing less cases than probably what is being monitored out there. It's different too. At academic gotcha. Centers, I don't think you have quite the volume that you do in private practice, but
right.
it's right. definitely different.
So from the technologist side of things, you know, what is, you know, one or two things that technologists could do that, you know, would make things easier for you as a reading neurologist, as far as, you know, being able to, you know, monitor multiple cases simultaneously?
Oh, this is not going to win me any supporters. So the number one thing, and I cringe to say it because I know nobody does it, measurements, head measurements, not just with EEG, which is my big harp, but with, you would be shocked at how much head measurements help your SSEPs, mm-hmm. your MEPs, everything. And there's data to back this up because some of those are near field responses. And so if you're just guessing, you could be as much as 2-3 centimeters
right.
anterior posterior to where you are. And there's a reason why those responses look like they're attenuating in the transcortical channel, but not the midline channel. And that's because you've got brain side because you weren't over the generator. You don't yep. have that, what, 1 centimeter radius or so, or diameter. So that's always a sticking point and has a lot to do with time. And the only thing I can say to that is practice, practice, practice. People yep. come to me and they're like, what tips and tricks can I have to get faster at this? You know, the 1020 system just takes so much time. How can I get practice? I still have, they're not on my desk right now, but I still have my styrofoam heads that I yep. practice with.
Yep.
And I don't even hook patients up anymore, but I do it to kind of remind myself there is no easy workaround. There is no easy answer. The answer is practice. It's reviewing it. It's getting used to measurements. Even if you only get like a few of the measurements correct, like the coronal and the sagittal, that's still a lot better than just, okay, we're guessing. Up from,
yep.
from the, you know, tragus. Okay. That's about right.
Yep.
It's shocking how much of a difference that would make. And then number two would be basics, basics, basics. It is shocking to me. I have monitored with over 60 different companies, hundreds of technologists across the United States. And it is shocking to me how little we as a field know about the basics. And I'm talking about running train of four before you do anything motor related. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about super maximal stimulation on SSEPs. I'm talking about getting multiple trials before calling an MEP reliable. Little things like that that just go by the wayside. Coming from EEG, where things are actually pretty rigid and pretty standardized, to IONM, where there's just this range of variability with something mm-hmm. that basic is shocking. I think we could do ourselves as a field a lot of favors by making sure we're doing the basics appropriately. The best technologists, in addition to being willing to work with me, the best technologists that I work with know the basics, do the basics, do them the same way every time, and have them down cold.
Yep. Yeah, I completely agree with you on both of those. Measuring and marking, that's a soapbox issue for me. People don't think about it, but especially when we're doing transcranial motor evoke potentials, it's actually, a patient safety issue. Because if you're not over top of the motor cortex and you are hoping to activate the motor cortex, you have to turn up your voltages higher, right? I mean, just it's the inverse square law. So the further away from the motor cortex you are, significantly more voltage you have to deliver, which, then causes, a risk of tongue lacerations, fracturing teeth, lip bites. But also, we don't know what that voltage is doing to our patients. If we're activating motor cortex and sensory cortex, who knows what other parts of the brain, we're activating, and we don't know, what we're necessarily doing, long-term to that patient. So from a safety standpoint, I think measuring and marking is important. One of the other interviews that I did, I think anesthetic, having a good anesthetic is also important to patient safety, just for the same reason, especially when it comes to motors. And yeah, I agree with the basics. The more you know, and the more you dig into, the better decisions that you can make for that patient, and the better care that you can provide. So yeah, I completely agree with both of those.
That's in part why I love moderating your course, and your course is excellent because you go over all of this. Well, and you always think I'm just like patting you on the back, but it is true. Like you are covering basic stuff that I think gets overlooked, and I don't know how or why it gets overlooked. Perhaps it's being rushed in the OR. Perhaps it's because you want to go do the cool fun stuff like mapping. I don't know what it is, but I can tell you that like constant reminders, you never know when going over the basics will save you. Mm-hmm. And I know it saved me. It's got me reliable visual evoke potentials because I re-reviewed the band pass for VEPs intraoperatively. Mm-hmm. Little things that you forget, like it never hurts to go over them. Then again, I'm a creature of repetition. The more I hear it, and from the more varied sources that I hear it, the more it sticks, the more it's accessible. It's more accessible mentally. So I love your course. People should definitely, come see your course, because that's, if you want a place to start on the basics, that's a great place to start. And well, we need it.
I love delivering that course. So
you're very good at it. Thanks. And keep letting me on it.
Always. So, when I'm teaching, my mantra to everybody is troubleshoot before you have to troubleshoot. And if you know the basics mm-hmm. and you're thinking about the basics, you're eliminating so many issues for yourself, that when you have to troubleshoot, then you can say, this check, this check, this check. Those are all good. I know that they're good because of the way that I set things up and the way that I approach my patients. So it has to be, X or Y, but it can't be A, B, or C. So
nice. And that would just save so much time too. I mean, I've had 3 cases already this week where the tech was like, oh, we're in alert, left ulnar, right PTN, something. And I'm like, we're only at 15 on the ulnar. Can we go up 5 milliamps?
Mm-hmm.
And when you know it, it's stable for the rest of the case after that.
Pops so right back.
I completely agree with you. Like an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure for sure.
I completely agree. All right. So what is your favorite part of the field of, well, and because you have, multiple, certifications, did I use the right word? Okay. EEG, IONM, what are your favorite parts of both of those worlds?
Both of those worlds? Honestly, the techs. Honestly, you guys. I love you guys. I think you guys are so important, so instrumental. I love getting to know you. I've had some really great relationships with some of you. I'd like more relationships with more of you. I would like to help change the field with you guys. But you guys are just some of the best people to work with in medicine. So I know that sounds cheesy, but I mean, you guys have made it for
me. Kind of cheesy, but
yeah. I'm a cheesy kind of person. It's all right. But getting to work with you guys in this capacity, getting to do medicine that can be very analytical, very high stakes. I just think that is a lot of fun. And I say that gingerly because if it's fun for us, it's probably not fun for the patient. And that will always bother me. But if it means that they, like for neuro-oncology, if they have a few more weeks, months, years with their loved ones, if they have a better quality of life, then it's worth it.
Yep.
Definitely you guys. We just had ASNM. You were there. It was excellent. It was a really fun time getting to meet all you guys and to talk to you guys. And I would love to know, what it is that you guys want and want to do and what makes a good reading physician and all of that stuff. So I learn a lot from you guys. Nice. So yeah. Nice right. Cheesy answer, but that is you
we'll,
guys.
We'll take it.
You guys make my day. I actually have a Word document because I'm human and we all need this, right? I have days where it's hard and you're slugging through and it just doesn't feel good. I actually have a Word document of any anytime any technologist has said something nice to me, I've saved it, and that has saved me for sure on several days where it just feels dark. It feels like, what am I doing here? It doesn't feel right. I go and I read some of that and I'm like, okay, I'm grounded again. I feel better. So yeah, you guys do make it.
Nice. That's an interesting practice. I think it's important for people to, kind of pull back from, the forest that they're in and kind of get above that and look at, the entirety of the forest and why you're doing what you're doing. And remember, you're doing this for the patients, but you're also doing this to make a difference, in the lives of the technologists that you work with, the surgeons that are working with the patients, but yeah, most importantly, the patients. But so what is your favorite case type to monitor and why?
Gosh, favorite case type. There's just so many. So many are really cool. I guess if I was only to do one case from here on out for the rest of my life, it'd probably be cranies that involve like phaser, like mappings, essentially.
Gotcha. Okay.
It would be mappings. But I love spinal cord mapping. That's a lot of fun. I love anything EEG. And if anyone ever had any questions, EEG, like I would hope that they would ask too, whether I'm on the case with you or not.
Nice.
But anything kind of rare, like even, I hate to use the word experimental, but that's kind of what it is. If it's little used, not a lot written about it, and we're giving it a try, like as long as we know we have an appropriate safety profile, because again, it is all about the patient and the last thing I want to do is have anything bad happen to them. But if it's within the appropriate safety profile, like within some of the techniques that we already do, let's try it. Let's do it. So anything experimental, anything mapping related, whether it's brain or spine, probably my favorite.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So speaking of mapping, what did you think about some of the things that so we all saw the presentation at ASNM. I think it was Dr. Chang.
The presidential speaker.
Yes,
that was awesome.
That was I mean that's the kind of stuff that makes me think, wow. I mean, this field has a long ways to go. I mean, for those that weren't there, you know, he talked about the language mapping that they are doing so that they can train computers using AI models to interpret the brain activity to produce speech for patients that have, you know, had a brainstem stroke or something where they've lost their ability to speak. And some of the stuff that they're, I mean, it's very obviously investigational right now, but some of the stuff that they were, that he was able to demonstrate is just, I mean, amazing that we can actually get that detailed. And, you know, I sat there thinking, you know, the mapping that we do and the things that we do, it feels like the difference between, you know, the 1900s when they would, you know, work on patients' brains without anesthesia and how we thought that that was barbaric. And now, you know, we think we're so refined in what we do, but to see where the field could go and where it is going, I mean, the things that we do now are, you know, very, very rudimentary, I think, to what we're headed to, which is really inspiring.
I think that's an excellent way to describe it. And it's hard to appreciate that when we do this, you know, a couple times a week and it's really cool and we get good results. But yeah, I love too how Dr. Chang was really utilizing like high density ECOG to pull this information from to train the computer. I mean, that is incredible. I actually was so impressed with that lecture that I went up to Olga and Lanjun and asked if I could come spend a week with them.
Nice. So are you going to go spend a week with them?
I hope so. I mean, that's one of the benefits of living in the Bay Area. They're just down. Well, they're not, it's a 2-hour drive, but they're down
the
street.
It's close.
So
yeah.
Yes. So I would love to, if I got to see some of that, oh my gosh, that'd be amazing.
And yeah, and I mean, you think about how is AI going to impact, you know, our field and where is AI headed? And then you see some of the uses like that. Yeah, it's pretty amazing the things that I think we're going to be able to do using some of the, you know, large language models and some of the new technology that's coming out. So, all right. So you have been elected as the upcoming ASNM president, and you talked about, you know, wanting to change the field or have an impact in the field. So as president, you're going to have an opportunity to do that. So what are some of the things that you have, you know, on your short list that you want to accomplish, you know, during your presidency?
That's a really good question. A couple of things. I do think that we, and you're on the board now too, so you're in part responsible for this with me. We have an obligation to make the meetings more than just education, high quality education. I think that they've done a really good job in the past. This is not a knock to anything that's been done, but I do think one area that we need to work on, in addition to high quality education, is networking and mentoring for sure. And that doesn't have to be formal necessarily. Yep. I would be happy to meet up with people. I mean, people email me for articles or my opinion or to go over a lecture or anything like that. It could be things like that. So I think that we, as like the board, I think Rich in particular tried very hard to make this a welcoming, open meeting. And I think he succeeded. He and Brian really succeeded. So that's something I'd like to see expanded upon more. I would like to hear more from the CNIM portion of our membership too, for a lot of reasons. Number one, CNIMs are the biggest part of our membership. Yet I feel like they have the smallest voice. And I don't feel comfortable with that at all, knowing how you guys are treated. And what I mean by that is you have a tough job. You have a high stakes, high stress job, even if it's spinal fusions, even if it's the non, you know, complex modality cases. And like any work in medicine, the climate of work is not necessarily the friendliest all the time. It would be great to have the ASNM be a friendly place for you guys to come and to hang out and to relax, do all those kinds of things. Hang out with me and James. We're bunches of fun, aren't we, James? We're a fun crowd, right?
No, we are a fun crew.
We're nice. We're friendly. We promise. So I'd like to do that. And in turn, like getting people to the meeting, I want to set up a lot of scholarships. That would be my dream, is to set up scholarships. Find ways to get money. There's money out there. Mm-hmm, find ways to get money to get people to these meetings. Because right now, with the cost of everything, just being alive, it's tough. It's very tough. So I think, you know, us as the board, making it a more collegial, camaraderie type of experience, getting people there, hearing more about what you guys want and need as CNNs, those are kind of my goals, at least coming up. Okay. So on that note, if anyone is listening to this and has any concerns or thoughts or anything they want to share, I would highly encourage that. I would welcome that.
Okay, wonderful. So how does it feel to have been voted as ASNM president-elect?
It's interesting. I didn't really expect to win. So it's a little overwhelming. I'm a little shocked that I'm president, and yet there are some other people who haven't been president yet. I would have thought that they would have come before me. So it's a very weird experience. I did agree to it because I'm up for the job. That's not a question. I just figure, you know, a lot of these people are better known in the field than I am. So it's interesting. I would like to do a good job. I think I can do the best job possible the more I hear from you guys and the more I know what you guys want and what you are perceiving and what you'd hope to see. So yeah, it's been a trip.
Well, I think you'll do a great job. So I'm looking forward to working with you on the board.
Yeah, I am so glad that you're on there. We have a really good board. We have a nice mix of experiences, a nice mix of opinions. We've got a few doctors, some PhDs, some CNMs. I think it's a good mix right now.
Yeah, so I would agree. What do the next 10 years hold or look like for Dr. Mora?
Well, hopefully all in IONM and EEG. That's a great question. So there's a couple projects I'm working on. So first of all, I just want to keep monitoring with you guys and finding new and interesting ways to help serve and help our patients. I think that there's a lot that we can do. One of the projects that I'm looking at right now is actually extending IONM outside of the OR just a little bit. Ooh. That happens more on vascular cases. That's probably more where we have the capacity for it, but looking, you know, how to do that. I think that's very important, that perioperative theater, we kind of miss some things for the patients, for their safety. And I think that can extend beyond vascular cases. So looking at extending the reach of IONM outside the OR is one. Talking about AI, we were talking about Dr. Chang's lecture. Another project that I'm working on is using AI for IONM EEG education.
Okay.
And so basically training AI or using an AI program to assist with that so that there's something kind of immediate right there at people's fingertips that they can use to test their knowledge, to kind of gain some skills, get a little bit of confidence with this, all from the ability of your smartphone, something like
okay. that. Okay. So is that then, like using programming a language model with AI or with IONM related materials so that people can query that the language model specifically trained on intraoperative monitoring or?
So it's not a language model. So the way that the AI works is actually by identifying, training the AI to identify different EEG abnormalities as
Oh,
seen
okay.
on intraoperative monitoring EEG. So there's the subsection of normal that you have to identify and train the AI on. So that would be things like a alpha theta background and the variations in continuity and things like that, differentiating the discontinuous from burst suppression. It can be extended to ECOG, looking at after discharges and the way that those evolve, and being able to train the AI to classify when, based on the parameters set, when do you want to start calling this a seizure versus not, kind of thing.
Gotcha.
So it's more training the AI, not necessarily on language, but on pattern recognition,
Okay, gotcha.
which is actually a lot tougher than you might think, because frequencies can look deceivingly, like a beta frequency can come from a deceiving number of places. One area, I don't know if people are familiar, but there's a great anesthesiologist. I think he's at MIT, Emery Brown. He's given a lecture, Dr. Emery Brown's given a lecture for ASNM, and he's used spectrograms to try to classify different electrographic signatures of anesthetic agents. And the pro like which is brilliant, and he's took like taken a lot of time to look into burst suppression and other things. The problem is that not all beta frequencies are created equal, right? You could have myogenic that's in the beta range, beta gamma range, but you could also have that from just the brain's background, and you can have it from anesthesia. So there's actually a lot more finesse into training the AI into trying to detect which beta you want it to look at. Do you have it look at all beta just right off the bat? Do you try to narrow it down from there? It's actually a little bit of a tougher process than one might think.
Gotcha.
But
Interesting.
AI, it's very interesting. AI, I think the big fear is, well, AI, is going to replace us. AI is not going to replace us. People who know how to use AI is what's going to replace us. So definitely, like, getting on board and trying to read and find out some of what's going on. I don't know. I'm actually learning a ton about it. I don't know as much as some. There are some groups that are really doing this in like the outpatient setting for routine EEGs and LTM EEGs and EMU EEGs. We have a whole nother arena, so to speak, in IONM EEG, but it's very fascinating what some people are able to do. It's really cool.
Yeah, I think AI is going to make us better at what we do. I don't think it's necessarily going to replace what we do. I mean, it may replace some of the things that we do, but that will expand capacity for us to provide, I think, even better monitoring. So,
I think so too. And to provide more monitoring to
yeah.
places that may not otherwise have it. I think, if you have an AI trained algorithm somewhere rural where you don't have even a reading physician that can reach that's operating remotely, that could still be something that under the right circumstances and under the right parameters could be very useful.
Yep, I agree. Interesting. Okay. So that kind of leads into the next question, which is where do you see the field of IONM heading in the next 10, 15, 20 years?
That's a great question, and I actually think it's a little bit of a cautionary tale. I think that we have let, and this happens with different areas of medicine, but it's pretty prevalent in IONM. We are letting some other people kind of write the IONM story, and we're taking a little bit of a back seat, and we really need to step up as a profession and be. The problem, I think, is one of unity, and it's one of getting up and actually doing the ugly bit of this, which is kind of essentially politicking. So I think that there has been, I mean, some division, some groupings within our field. I don't think anyone would argue with that. I think we need to really appreciate each other for the roles that we each play, because they're all important. And the more that we can be united and kind of tell different entities, actually, this is the way it's going to do. And yes, we do know best. We're the ones doing this day in and day out. I think that that would be very powerful. And I think we're actually getting there. I say it's a cautionary tale because if we don't do that, then I think INM will look very different in 10 years and not necessarily for the better, which is all the more reason why we need to be very good at the basics, be very competent in what we do, communicate well, be courteous to each other. I think that if we have that kind of a united front, we could really do some good things and show like how helpful and how wonderful our field is.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I really hope I would want to work with as many people as possible to try to get that going. I don't mind whatever anyone's story is. I think that there's a lot that the more that we'll get done together.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. What do you think are the, to, I guess, move our field in the right direction and, you know, to take control of our destiny as, you know, a neuromonitress, what do you think are the top three things that, you know, we need to do in very short order in order to, you know, steer the ship or right the ship?
Well, I think there, first of all, collaboration. There needs to be a lot more of that because of the nature of IONM and its utility. In order to have good literature, I think we're going to have a bunch of multi-center studies to help show the validity and utility of what we do. That's the problem with having things go wrong, going correct 99% of the time, and we're there for that 1%. The problem is, right, is when that 1% goes wrong, that's when we really step up. So I think I know that some people are already looking into this. I think Justin Silverstein and his group they're trying to reach out to some centers. I know some other academic institutions are working together. There's a European coalition that's doing a lot of really good work as well. So I think that is huge. And I think we are starting to see more of that. So that is definitely something to consider. And it doesn't necessarily have to be institutions, academic institutions. It can absolutely be groups that are, mm-hmm. You know, kind of spread out across the country. NMA, Empower, Specialty Care, NuVasive, and a bunch of the smaller groups kind of pooling data together, collaborating to try to do what John Nay and others have done, showing utility, particularly in a cost-effective manner, would be huge. So collaboration would be one. We really, as a field, we kind of almost pigeonhole ourselves into the literature a little bit. I see a lot of studies on the same thing kind of over and over, just kind of rewriting it, but in a different way. I think we need to think outside the box a little bit more, especially with Medicare and governmental payers cutting reimbursements. We are going to have to get creative, which is another reason why I think exploring extending IONM to the perioperative area would be very useful. I think probably those two things, really improving the literature and collaboration, are probably two of the biggest.
Gotcha. I certain organizations like SRS, for instance, as to be a member of the Scoliosis Research Society, the physicians that are members have to agree to contribute their data to the database so that, you know, they can publish, you know, and do research on that. I know there's probably some conflicting opinions about, you know, doing something like that with ASNM membership. But I think something like that would potentially, you know, increase the materials that we have to work with, you know, to write papers on, to do retrospective studies, you know, and to publish on, to hopefully, you know, solidify some of the evidence for, you know, what we do.
That would be terrific if we can do something like that, especially like with the guidelines and other things as like a springboard. The person who took over research too, Katie Overzet, I mean, the work she has done.
Yeah, she's done great work.
Holy moly. Just in the last year and a half. And I mean, she's even started by trying to form like a centralized library, and that's at least a start. But I agree with you. If there were some central hub, I don't know what the ins and outs of having ASNM do that are, but even if that's not a viable option, there's a bunch of great minds in this field who could figure out a solution to it. And I think we just, you know, have to talk to each other.
Yeah, no, I agree. Interesting. Okay. We've been going for about an hour and 15 minutes here, so I'll start wrapping up. The final questions for you. What are the three people that have had the most significant impact on your life, and you know, in the professional realm and in the personal realm?
Can I do four?
Sure.
So three are both my parents and my husband.
Okay.
I have learned so much from them. I'm very, very lucky to have had the family that I do have. They were instrumental. My mom's big thing was always kindness and empathy. I really appreciate that. So marrying my husband opened my eyes to it's interesting how similarly we were raised, but how different our worldviews are and just how we approach things. Mm-hmm. He's very logical and level headed, and that has been wonderful to learn from, and just their love and support. And then professionally, I actually have to go back to the good Dr. David Burdett.
Gotcha.
Never before have I had somebody that cared that much about their patients, that they just knew everything there was to know about anything epilepsy all the time, every single day. He lived and breathed the stuff. He still does. I think he's still over at Spectrum. And he was the type of person that would let you do as much or as little as you wanted. And so he let me do all sorts of really cool things, including extraoperative mapping. So I am
nice.
Forever grateful to him, for sure. So those four people, cheat a little bit. We'll count my parents as
okay.
one.
But, all right. Now, but now you said you talked about why your mom, but what about your dad? What are the qualities of your dad that he taught you that had the impact on you?
So my dad, probably this is a little bit funny, but he probably the hard work, like just never, ever giving up. That is one thing. His thing growing up was, it's not that it doesn't work, we just haven't found the right solution.
Gotcha.
And so that,
I like that.
It was frustrating growing up, because as a kid you don't understand that at all, and you don't start to get it until you really, you know, go off kind of on your own, maybe high school, maybe college, and you start to see, yeah, I don't have the luxury of giving up on this or that, or you know, without some pretty bad consequences. So okay, that didn't work. Let's go find another solution. That solution didn't work. Let's go find this one. So just his dogged, like, endurance and endurance to things.
Gotcha.
Has just been huge.
Nice.
My parents were actually quite similar, because he's very much a please and thank you person too. So I appreciate that very much.
Nice. Okay. All right. So moving from people, to books, what are the three books that have had the most impact on you, or meant the most to you, and why?
Meant the most to me at any time in my life?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh. Limiting it to three is tough. So I remember in my childhood, Eyewitness Books was the name of the publisher, I think, and they put out books on all different topics. But when I was a kid, I loved their rocks and minerals manual. I would go out with my dad's crowbar or sledgehammer around our house, find rocks and crack them open and see if I could match them to the rocks and minerals in the book. Like, that was my idea of a fun summer. It was hilarious. Good practice for firefighting too, which brings me to book number two. And this was the book that I was reading when I kind of thought I wanted to do firefighting. And this is the book that sold me on it. It's Fighting Fire by Carolyn Paul. I believe she was one of the first female firefighters for San Francisco.
Okay.
I don't know if she was the first, but she is one of the first ones going, like her detailing what she had to do both physically and mentally to prepare for that. And the big thing is, it was male dominated, but I think her struggle was actually one more of a physical nature than a mental nature. And just her overcoming, not even overcoming, but building yourself up to that. I was like, yeah, I can do this. And then I don't want to go into like nerd books, like textbooks, because I feel like that's all I read. But the last book I read in college, and it just really was, this guy is so interesting. It's the great theoretical physicist, Dr. Richard Feynman. And he wrote a book called What Do You Care What Other People Think of You? And that's just a very fun, it's not anything necessarily to do with physics, because, I mean, let's be real, I wouldn't understand a word of that. But just some of his experiences and the way that he approached things, his mind was just so different. And that was just so much fun to read. So go read books on rocks and minerals, people. It's stress relieving. Go. That's a shout out to Matthew Cotton, too, by the way, who had some very interesting geology stories at ASU. Loved it. So go read that. Go read Fighting Fire, and go read What Do You Care of Other People Think of You by Richard Feynman.
Nice. Great. Okay. So what we've learned here is if neurology does not work out for you, geology will.
And if geology doesn't work out, I'm going to have to teach myself, either reteach myself firefighting or teach myself theoretical physics. Yes, that is correct.
That's funny.
I'm in big trouble.
I think neurology is working out for you, so.
Load off, thank goodness.
All right, so wrapping up here then, what parting thoughts do you have for the NeuroPod community?
Well, thank you guys so much for tuning in and for listening. Keep learning, keep asking questions. I can tell you as a reading neurologist, and I know I'm only one, but I appreciate you guys so much. The technologists, I really appreciate what you do. I'm very grateful for what you do. Keep learning, keep trying to be better. Remember who we're there for. It is all about the patient. That's my mom, my brother, my husband, my dad, my friend on the table. I want to be able to serve them the absolute best that I can, the safest that I can. I want them to be the same person walking out of the hospital as they are walking in. And no one has the ability to influence that more than we do with the surgeon. So keep learning, keep mastering the basics, keep reminding yourself. I have to every day. I have my stack of flashcards right here on my desk right next to me. I may not have the styrofoam head, but I do have the flashcards. I need daily reminders. So keep going, but remember who we're there for. Remember how much you're appreciated. The work that you do is important, and just thank you for all that you do. And thank you, James, for doing this. You are an outstanding educator. You're wonderful, for a wonderful supporter and advocate for our field. And I hope you, myself, the ASNM board, anyone who wants to get involved can do good things for our field.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Michelle and Dr. Mora. Appreciate having you on the podcast. And I told you at the beginning, but there's a lot of technologists in the neuromonitoring world that enjoy working with you. Your name always comes up to the top of the list when neurologists that people prefer to work with are being discussed. So keep up what you're doing. And how do people contact you?
Yeah. Anyway, contact me via email, contact me via phone. Text is probably best, just because I find that the older I get, the less I can multitask. But message me and I will try to get back to you. James, if you don't mind sharing my contact info,
okay,
my email and my phone number. Honestly, I would love to hear from you guys. I may not have the answer to whatever question it is, but I'll sure try to point you in the right direction. And even if you just want to chit chat, I would love to hear from any and all of you. So please, please always feel like you can reach out. I have people message me at 4 a.m, at 10 p.m. I try to answer as soon as I can, but I would love to hear from you guys.
Well, thank you.
And James, thank you for having me on. This has been a pleasure.
Yeah, sure, I've really enjoyed it. So look forward to working with you on the next ASNM board prep webinar. So
yes, I'm looking forward to. So if you guys want to join us in the fall, I think it's September, right, James?
I think it is. I don't have the dates in front of me. I should know that.
I don't either, but check the ASNM website, check social media. We'll probably post something on LinkedIn. Please join us. You won't be disappointed, I promise. So,
well, thank you, Dr. Mora, and you have a great evening.
You too. See you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Neuropod content is intended for personal use and general information purposes only. Neuropod cannot guarantee the accuracy of any statements made by guests or the sufficiency of the information. The opinions and views expressed by guests do not necessarily reflect or represent those of the host or producers. Such views are opinions of the guests and should not be used to inform appropriate patient care or for legal purposes. If you have specific medical concerns or questions, you should contact your healthcare provider. It is the listener's responsibility to confirm the accuracy of opinions and views before putting them into practice. Neuropod disclaims any and all liability for injury or other damages for all claims which may result from the use of the information presented.